This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.
And the ability to vote should never be tied to how much money is in your bank account. It's a matter of you registering and voting in the election, whatever your party may be.
And with that, a judge rules being poor shouldn't stop Florida felons from voting. The ACLU's Melba Pearson makes the case.
I work with many school systems across the state of Florida, and almost every single teacher, principal, even the community members, when I'm out in the communities there, are very much in for keeping the standards the way they are.
Educators like Brian Dean with Instruction Partners are calling on state officials to improve, not eliminate, Florida's academic standards. And when it comes to climate change in Florida, a new report shows Florida's 15 seaports are leading the nation in resiliency.
Add in conditions like a sea level rise, as incremental as that may be, there comes a time where our ports have to start addressing the level of their infrastructure.
We hear from Doug Wheeler at Florida Ports Council.
All that and more coming up on episode 167 of The Rotunda.
Welcome to the program. There's been quite a lot of buzz surrounding our last episode featuring former Florida Congresswoman and gubernatorial candidate, Gwen Graham. After speaking enthusiastically about her work with an organization called Rebuild 850, formed after Hurricane Michael to aid recovery in the Panhandle.
Essentially, it was my old congressional district that took the greatest hit.
She was asked to step down by her longtime friend and Rebuild 850 coordinator, Ron Sachs, due to her criticism of Governor Ron DeSantis. In a statement, Sachs said, Gwen, who has every right as a citizen to express strong opinions that are political in nature, but as volunteers with Rebuild 850, which is completely non-political and non-partisan, it's not appropriate to take personal shots at the governor or anybody. End quote. You can listen to what Graham had to say on episode 166 of The Rotunda. Graham took the news in stride, keeping her commitment to help Rebuild 850 outside of the organization, and has said she will not be silenced. And that segues into this week, as she also slammed Governor Ron DeSantis for not vetoing a bill which imposes additional restrictions after Floridians voted overwhelmingly on Amendment 4 to restore voting rights of ex-felons. That's 1.4 million felons, which made the largest expansion of voting rights in the country in 50 years. But the Republican-controlled legislature passed a bill that said only felons who paid all fines, fees, and restitution could register. Voting rights groups sued on behalf of a handful of felons, arguing in part that the law is a poll tax that will permanently disenfranchise poorer people with felony convictions.
What do we want?
I was outside the federal courtroom when both sides were arguing the case. I spoke with Melba Pearson, deputy director of the ACLU of Florida, which is part of the lawsuit.
So going back to after the election and seeing the passage of Amendment 4, what was actually supposed to happen?
What actually did happen, the Amendment 4 went into effect and people were able to go to their supervisors of elections. They, of course, did check their status to make sure that they were eligible under this new law, but they went and they registered to vote. And then at that time, they were eligible to vote in some municipal elections. I had the privilege of being in Miami witnessing some returning citizens registering to vote and watching them become very emotional, because for some of them it was the first time they voted in their adult lives, or it was the first time they voted in 20 years because of this unfair scheme and regime that was happening prior to the passage of Amendment 4. So how it's supposed to work is that as long as you have completed the terms of your sentence and done what the court ordered you to do, then you should be eligible to vote. You just have to go and register and then proceed from there. And that's the way it's supposed to work. There should not be additional conditions on top of what the court imposed.
I'm just going through the visual timeline. And then what happened?
But then SB 766 was passed in the legislature. It passed, I believe, in March of this year, March, April, somewhere in the spring. And now it has gone into effect. It's gone into effect this month. So at this juncture, now we have a situation where it's a wealth-based system. If you have outstanding fines that were converted to a civil lien because the court determined you were never going to have the ability to pay, today, now you're in a situation where you're no longer eligible to vote. And that's just wrong, and that's plain wrong. So that's why we've gone to court and we've asked for an injunction. And that injunction would then stop SB 7066 from being in effect and return us to the original state of where we were in January of this year, where as long as you've finished your sentence, your community service hours, whatever it is the court ordered you to do, you were then able to register to vote.
Do you know how many people it affected? I guess it's hinging on that financial penalty.
Correct.
How many people fell into that jam?
So 1.4 million people received their right to vote as a result of Amendment 4. Mm-hmm. Our data is suggesting that only 20% of those people are now able to vote under SB 7066. So we have pretty much a million people who have now lost their right to vote again as a result of SB 7066. And if the injunction is granted, then people will be allowed to register to vote. So that is the best case scenario, while the rest of the legal machinations as to whether or not SB 7066 is constitutional, that will continue.
That was Melba Pearson with the ACLU of Florida. Heading into the weekend, the judge issued a preliminary injunction on behalf of the 17 plaintiffs in the suit. Judge Robert Hinkle said Florida cannot deny restoration of a felon's right to vote solely because the felon does not have the financial resources necessary to pay restitution. He adds plaintiffs have a constitutional right to vote so long as the state's only reason for denying the vote is failure to pay an amount the plaintiff is genuinely unable to pay. A spokeswoman for Governor Ron DeSantis says the ruling does not invalidate current law. So that leaves those outside of the 17 remaining in limbo until the federal trial centering around the law concludes. It's scheduled to begin in April 2020. Voting groups are celebrating the news anyway, expecting a similar result during that trial. This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. The Florida Standards Listening Tour is underway, launched by the Florida Department of Education to solicit public input on paving the way for new education standards for Florida students after the state eliminates Common Core by the end of the year. For the fifth time in 24 years, Florida is changing its education standards, but some educators say a complete overhaul is unnecessary. Back in January, Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order to ditch the set of academic standards in mathematics, arts, and literacy that outline what students should know at the end of each grade. Some parents argue the guidelines are too rigid and require too much testing for students. But math instructor Brian Dean with Instruction Partners says teachers, principals, and parents have said only small tweaks should be made. I caught up with Dean while he was at an education conference in Jacksonville.
It's the state conference for teachers of mathematics. And so it's awesome to see the energy and buzz. Like, there's so many math educators here. And the revision of the standards has come up as a topic. And you always hear, you know, it's a room full of grumbles when that occurs, right? And so, yeah, it's just teacher educators, instructional coaches, district specialists, they're all here to learn more on how we can best teach our students mathematics with our current standards. It just happened to coincide with when my local Hillsborough tour stopped, and so I couldn't attend. And so I was sad about that. But I'm here with over 800 math educators from the state of Florida, so I'm pretty happy about that.
All right. So you're out there, you're trying to voice support for Florida's standards and make sure it's not all thrown out.
Yeah. So, you know, for the minor revisions, because just, you know, I have a kid in our Florida system as well. And so he is currently in third grade. And so since he entered kindergarten, he has been interacting with our new standards, the Math Florida standards. And just the way in which, you know, even he has been, his instruction and the way in which he thinks about number and can compose and decompose number, it's just been amazing to see how his math mind works. And so I just want that to continue not just my kid, but all kids.
So what concerns do you have with this call for a complete revamp? And why do you think it should be more of like an incremental change, if any?
So, you know, the standards were written, they were based on progressions, like how kids learn math the best. And so I know, like, the word Common Core has its, like, when people hear that, some people think certain things. However, like with these standards, we have this common set of like how kids find math best. And we have now time has been spent with, you know, just training teachers and building knowledge around these standards and how we can best serve all students in learning mathematics at a high level. Teachers have worked so hard, and they're at a time and place now where we have many aligned materials that they can use. So they're not constantly having to like drum up a lesson plan from scratch. They can, you know, use a free resource that's aligned to the standards, or you know, a purchased curriculum as well that the district provides them. And all that goes away if we throw out these standards. Like we're back to where we were in 2010, where we have to give people time to understand the new standards, the progressions. They'll have to, you know, write new resources, and then in the meantime, we have teachers that deserve so much better.
So, what are you hearing from fellow educators and parents about this change?
I work with many school systems across the state of Florida, and almost every single teacher, principal, you know, even the community members, when I'm out in the communities, there are very much in for keeping the standards the way they are. They don't want to change. They understand the standards. They've put in the time and the effort to learn about the standards, and they see it working with their kids. They see it working. It's not the only measure of why it's working. You know, it's working on state testing results, but we see, you know, our state testing results going increasing year after year after year, and it's because, you know, we know the standards better, we know how to teach it better, and the kids are learning.
So, Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran announced the tour. How are people able to access and reach and voice their concerns? Are you hearing any feedback from fellow educators and parents about this and attending these listening sessions and hearing what the state officials have to say about their proposed changes?
It's a great question. I have some friends I've attended, Seminole and the one in Hillsboro. And it seems like attendance has been pretty low. And so just got to think about like who has access, the access and equity to attend these sessions. You know, geographically, the state of Florida is very large. And so to have 7 locations, it's nice to be able to provide feedback. So I definitely would like to thank them for allowing us to have a voice. But there's other ways to get feedback as well, right? And so we have the survey that they send out asking for feedback about the standard revision. Oddly enough, the first draft of that survey only asked for deficit language, like what we didn't like about the standards. But they did update that survey to ask about what we do like about the standards. So those people would have a voice too. And so that data they FLDOE released in, I think it was like May, it was clear that the vast majority said leave the standards alone. And then those that had suggestions. We're talking about, you know, a tweak here, a tweak there, because the standards are from 2010, and we know better now. We know more. We know how these standards work with our kids. So, yeah, we can update a few things. And that's what I'm hoping they're hearing at the listening tour is, yes, we'll meet in the middle. Let's update things that make sense. But to just do a complete overhaul and in particular, like change standards because we have a hard time measuring those standards because they're conceptual, I just have a hard time with that.
And the revised draft of the Florida Education Standards, seeing that, what are your thoughts of what they put forward and in their draft?
Yeah, and so I was able to see draft 2, and so through that draft, a lot of key verbiage that are in our current standards is gone. The word understand doesn't show up. Interpret, analyze doesn't show up as much as it used to. And so all these things that we want kids to be doing with the mathematics is no longer there. It very much seems a lot more procedural in nature. And that's where we've already been. And we know how that's worked out for us. And so we just have the momentum going right now with the balance. Math instruction should be a balance. There is a time and place to learn a concept. I really believe concepts always before procedures. And then always have that application woven in. And so we're not saying that procedures are bad and procedural things are bad, but it should be balanced instruction in math. And these current draft of standards don't include that balance.
So if you had the opportunity to sit before Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran, who of course has a background in the Florida legislature as Speaker of the House, what would you ask him regarding this proposed drastic shift?
Yeah, I would honestly seek to understand. I would like to know why would be it. Yeah, just a good explanation of why the desire to change when it seems like so many things and so much momentum is going in our favor for the current standards. And then ask, just help me understand. And so if we can try to meet in the middle somewhere, because I do agree there are some standards that, you know, that from the 2010 Common Core standards and then are now our Math Florida standards that could be tweaked or updated or more clarity around them. Like, even a good example would be, like, there's a clear progression on equations through middle school on how kids in sixth grade solve one step, seventh grade two step, eighth grade it goes to multi-step and combining like terms. But then we get to high school and it's vague. And so we can do some more specificity around that standard about what does it mean to solve equations in algebra one versus sixth grade, seventh grade, or eighth grade. Like, so yes, like, we can update these standards. But to throw them out and start over, and then everything we have is unusable, and then putting districts back in the square one of, you know, unpacking standards and understanding what the intent of each standard is. Like, we've done that. And so we don't need to go back there again.
And that was my conversation with Brian Dean, also known as the Math Whiz.
In addition to the listening tour, the public can submit feedback on each of the second draft standards individually at floridastandardsreview.org.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, bringing you stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. Each week, this program is supported by listeners like you. Visit rotundapodcast.com to share your feedback, pitch story ideas, or become an underwriter by sponsoring this program. Follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast. And be sure to visit rotundapodcast.com throughout the week for breaking news and previews into the upcoming episodes. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to the program. Florida is planning more for climate change. Actually, the topic is starting to get more play around the Capitol under the DeSantis administration and legislative leadership. Governor DeSantis is continuing to win praise from environmental groups. He even created the position of Chief Resilience Officer,
which some top Republicans like Senator Tom Lee,
who chairs the Senate Infrastructure and Security Committee, says there is substantial evidence that Florida's sea level is rising. Industries across the state are reviewing and updating their resiliency plans, including all of Florida's seaports, which just released a report showing Florida's ports are leading the nation in resiliency. I stopped by Florida's Ports Council for a quick chat with its president and CEO, Doug Wheeler, about their findings.
So, Doug Wheeler, I am here in your office, the Florida Ports Council. What is the Florida Ports Council all about?
Great. Tramell, thank you for coming by today. My name is Doug Wheeler. I'm the president and CEO of the Florida Ports Council. The Florida Ports Council represents Florida's deepwater seaports around the state, providing a collective voice for our ports in the areas of everything from advocacy. We do research and data collection, as well as marketing and communication.
I'm here because you guys just released a report, and it's showing the impending issue that Florida has to deal with, sea level rise. And it's showing that Florida's seaports are prepared to deal with that. So talk about that.
Well, so let's talk about quickly. The report defines seaport resiliency as a port's ability to move freight, and certainly in Florida's case, with the cruise industry being as large as it is, people, through a port during times of severe stress on both the infrastructure at the port as well as the operation of the port. And so Florida's ports have a tremendous economic impact in Florida. These activities are generating about $87 billion annually in trade. Supporting more than $900,000. So our ports really understand the importance of seaport resiliency and the impact that that has on making sure that our ports are able to continue to be an effective cog in this logistics supply chain.
So let's break that down. What does it mean for a seaport to be resilient?
Well, obviously, look, the seaports just on their simple location are already taking very hard conditions between the salt water and the constant wind. Add in conditions like a sea level rise, as incremental as that may be, You know, there comes a time where our ports have to start addressing the level of their infrastructure. So whether it's, electrical infrastructure or hard berth infrastructure, as they plan for that, and our ports are really, really good at doing master plans and making sure that those are in line with their local community goals. But that planning becomes so critical to make sure that, A, they're not getting ahead of it, right? So you can't build it so high ahead of sea level rise or a tidal surge from a storm that it makes the other equipment, incapable or incompatible with the vessels. But at the same time, be thinking far enough out that the lives of some of these infrastructure projects have 50 years. Mm-hmm. So you have to really make sure that as you look that far out, your infrastructure will be able to be resilient in the face of these disruptions.
So what are these incremental retrofitting look like? What will change at, say, Port Canaveral and these other ports?
Well, I think pretty much eventually everything. I would point to an interesting example, say, at Port Everglades. They are currently surveying all of their connection boxes on the port. These connection boxes are tied to key security and data communications networks that would be certainly damaged by encroaching water, again, from either tidal surge from a storm or a sea level rise. And so they're in the process of surveying all these connection boxes. They will identify those that need to be hardened. Those will be waterproofed. And then that will then put them in a much better position to deal with any sort of disruption in the future as those occur and be able to get that port back up and running as quickly as possible.
Doug, how does technology play into tracking sea level rise and preparing for making sure seaports are resilient?
Well, as with everything today, right, technology clearly plays a big role in a lot of what we're doing relative to resiliency. Two quick examples in Jacksport, that city, along with the Electrical Authority, has partnered to fund the Physical Oceanographic Real-Time System, known as PORTS. It offers monitoring data from 15 stations at dozens of locations up and down the St. Johns River, which is tracking rise and tidal surge and salinity. And that data is critical that technology provides. Also of interest is that our Florida seaports have invested in a single platform reporting system known as Command Bridge. It allows our ports to connect real-time data and information with not only each other, but with other key state and federal partners, including law enforcement and those like the Coast Guard and Customs and Border Patrol.
Okay. As we wrap up here, the importance of our seaports. What actually goes on at a seaport, for those who don't know?
Well, if you're talking cruise, and we are the cruise capital of the world, number 1, 2, and 3 cruise ports in the entire world, we're moving more than 16 million passengers a year. That's a tremendous industry in the state of Florida. We're also seeing a total economic impact of more than $117 billion from these activities that are occurring. A lot of that is to do with the cargo. And we're talking about cargoes that we use, products every day, food, fuel, just general consumer goods and products that are coming in and out of our port every day. And so, as I mentioned, these are huge economic benefits for the state. These activities are actually responsible for 13% of the state of Florida's GDP. So I think when you're talking about something that has such a huge economic impact in the state, it's critical that we continue to remain resilient relative to our seaport infrastructure as we continue to face these inevitable disruptions in the future.
That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Special thanks to Melba Pearson of the ACLU, Brian Dean of Instruction Partners, and Doug Wheeler of Florida Ports Council. Remember to follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast. Also, check us out at rotundapodcast.com, where you can contribute to this program and suggest topics and story ideas. And be sure to join us next week for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.